The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Spirited Conversations, a locally produced live recording of a keynote speaker. I'm Jan Marsh for Fresh FM and the Spirited Conversations Committee. Recently, Melissa Ansell-Bridges, the Secretary of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, led a discussion on the topic, with an election coming up, what's at stake for working people? Here's Barry McKee to introduce the evening.
Good evening. So welcome to the Spirit of Conversations tonight. Tonight we have a topic which relates directly to an even fast approaching event, an event which will affect us and all New Zealand. Our speaker, Melissa Ansell Bridges, will address changes that could well affect groups in society. The notice you have received gave details of her education and experience, and I don't plan to go any further detail into that. You will have deduced, as I, that she is well able to present the subject. With an election coming up, what's at stake for working people? I have pleasure in introducing and welcoming Melissa to speak to us now. Melissa?
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko ingarangi I rā o ko kotirana te whakapaparanga mai, engari ko Tamaki Makaurau te whenua tupu, ke te whanganui o Tara Ahau I anaine e no hoana, ko tangata Tiriti Ahau, ko Peter Bridges rā o ko Judith Ansell o ko mātua, ko te kauai kai mahi te mahi, ko Melissa Ansell Bridges toko ingoa. Tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora everyone, good evening. Thank you very much for having me this evening. It's lovely to be back in this part of the world. We were just talking before. I was actually born in Takaka, so you know, just over the hill. I only lived there for about 6 months before we uprooted and moved to Whangarei and then to Auckland. But I feel a strong heart connection to this part of the country as well. So it's lovely to be back in this part of the world. So as I said, my name is Melissa Ansell Bridges. I'm the Secretary of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, Te Kauai Kai Mahi. And I'll tell you a little bit about our organisation in case anyone who's not familiar with us. We're the peak body of the New Zealand union movement. So we have 31 affiliated unions, and across those unions collectively represent over 340,000 working people. So that makes us one of the largest democratic organisations in the country, which is a role that we take very seriously at all times, but feels particularly relevant during election time as well. We undertake a number of activities all around trying to advance the rights and conditions of working people through means which build the power and agency of working people to act collectively in their best interests as well. So our affiliated unions cover workers like teachers and nurses and bus drivers and people who work in retail, specialist doctors, actors. The list goes on. It's a very broad church. We campaign and we lobby for better working lives, and whilst not everybody who is in work is able to be a member of a union, the reality is that much of the work that we do benefits everybody, whether they're a union member or not. We're quite a small organisation, but we're also we pride ourselves on getting our voices heard. That looks very different for us, depending on who's in government. The nature of that relationship with government changes quite significantly. And I'm going to talk this evening about the upcoming election and some of the issues which we're really concerned about and focused on in the current election campaign, because we feel like there's a lot on the line this election. I've said before at previous elections that it's the most important election that we've ever had, and it feels like every subsequent election becomes the most important election that we've ever had, and maybe that's true, or maybe it's just, you know, you get so focused on the world of an election when they come around. But I do actually think that this one is the most important election ever, and I'm going to make an argument for that. Our current polling shows us that with the MMP system that we have, we're either going to end up with the most progressive government we've ever had, or the most far-right government that we've ever had. And that's just because of the parliamentary math. Both of the major parties are going to need support parties. So whilst the CTU isn't affiliated with any political parties, in our experience, we have had, as I said before, very different working relationships, depending on who's in government. And we, you know, I mean, it's no surprise, right? The Labour Party comes from the union movement, so you'd be pretty surprised if there wasn't a similarity in the values that we share and the objects which we're trying to achieve there. But we are distinct organisations. But there's a lot on the line this time round, so fair pay agreements, which I'll talk a bit more about shortly, a just transition to a low carbon economy, a strong public service, which includes, you know, adequate investment in education and health. Those are all things which are all on the line and which we think are really essential for the future of New Zealand. So sometimes people talk about the Labour Party and the CTU as though we are one and the same, and that's definitely not the case. And there have been times over the last 6 years where sometimes I wish that was more true when we're advocating around particular issues that we don't necessarily see eye to eye on. But as I said, the reality is that we're entirely different organisations. In our experience, though, there can be no doubt that the voices and the concerns of working people are certainly more easily heard and taken more seriously by the Labour Party, by the Green Party, and arguably by Te Pāti Māori as well. And it's our belief that our values are much more in alignment with this side of the aisle. In election times, we often hear interesting things and ideas which can seem a little bit ridiculous. And the risk of misinformation as well has become increasingly of concern over the last couple of years, particularly post-COVID. And unfortunately, we don't think that it's going away anytime soon. So one of the things which we've done this time round is roll out misinformation education so that working people can be better skilled in identifying and understanding and responding to misinformation when it comes across their path. But aside from where that kind of misinformation is actually quite deliberate and calculated, you know, there's a lot of opinion which we don't necessarily agree with, which happens, you know, from all sides of political debate. One of the issues that we've had this time round has been the conversation around the public service and claims that the public service is bloated. And we fundamentally disagree with that. We actually analysed the ratio of public servants as a percentage of the general working population, and it sits at about 20%, and it's consistently sat at about 20% of the working population for a very long time now. So that's currently, it was the case under Jacinda Ardern, it was the case under Bill English, it was the case under John Key, consistently about 20%. And that's also pretty standard internationally as well. So this narrative that the public service is bloated and it's too big and we've got to cut something crazy like 15,000 jobs before Christmas is just not true. And for us, it's of particular concern as well, because this is the public sector that helped us navigate our way through COVID. And it's the same public sector that's on track to end Mycoplasma bovis, which is a cattle disease that's been eradicated nowhere else in the world. And it's the public sector that built a record number of state and transitional houses and which delivers the winter energy payments and the best start payment. And we know the value of the public sector, which is why the notion of coming in and cutting thousands of those roles at haste seems really risky to us, particularly because a lot of those jobs are the kind of jobs that you really need, but you don't know that you really need until you really need them, and then it's too late to try and get them. And we don't want to end up in a situation like the weather events that we had earlier on this year, which have impacted and continue to impact thousands of New Zealanders, or any of the other crises that New Zealand has experienced in the last 4, 5, 6 years without a strong public sector, because they act as the safety net that supports us all in those times of crisis, but also helps us grow and thrive in other areas as well. I want to talk about a little bit about some of the great things that have happened over the last 6 years, because whilst there have been a lot of challenges in that time, from our perspective for working people, there have also been a huge number of wins as well, which we're really, really pleased with. Things like sick leave doubling to 10 days, which means that you know, people who get COVID, because that's still a reality for a lot of people, or who have responsibilities looking after their children as well. I have a 2-year-old, they get sick all of the time. Now I'm better supported to be able to take sick leave, not come into work and risk getting other people sick, but actually take the rest that they need to get healthy before going back to work. Matariki is a public holiday. Huge fan of public holidays, because life shouldn't all be about work every day. That's not the raison d'etre, right? That's not the be-all and end-all. But also recognising the significance of Matariki culturally in New Zealand is well overdue. And so that's a development worth celebrating. We've also had record low unemployment during this time at a time when internationally that's not been the case in many places. An issue which is particularly close to my heart as well, prior to working at the CTU, I was the director of Equity New Zealand, which is the union for actors. The Screen Industry Workers Act has passed, and it creates a mechanism for contractors in the screen industry to be able to collectively bargain terms and conditions across the whole industry. This was Labor's response to the Hobbit Act, which many of you might recall from 2010, where literally overnight the rights of people working in the screen industry were stripped from them, and they were prevented from being able to challenge their employment status as to whether they were employees or contractors. And you know, a really shameful exhibition of just how quickly we can pass legislation in New Zealand. So that's been a really great development. Public service contractors are now paid the living wage. We have leave available for victims of domestic violence so that they can take the time that they need to leave safely and prepare, you know, for their new lives and attend to, unfortunately, the significant amount of administration which can exist in situations of, you know, trying to leave abusive relationships. The minimum wage has continued to rise and gets ever closer to the living wage as well. Paid parental leave has been extended to 26 weeks so that people can actually spend adequate time with their new babies. and thousands of people have been supported with the training incentives allowance. And the list goes on and on and on. And one of the things that I want to spend a little bit more time talking about is the huge advances which have been made in the pay equity space. This is an issue which is not new. In fact, the original Equal Pay Act was passed in 1972, so it's been, you know, long overdue to actually really be making the kind of ground that we have been in the last couple of years. But since the Equal Pay Amendment Act was passed a few years ago, over 150,000 people have benefited from settlements under that act. Over 150,000 people, significant number. And on average, the pay corrections, because they're not rises, they're not pay rises, they are pay corrections for historic underpayment, is just over 30%, which is a significant increase, if you can imagine what that means for often very low-paid workers, having a 30% increase. And for me, that figure is bittersweet because it's fantastic that that correction happens, but it also reflects an undervaluation which has existed often for a very, very long time. And so there's a sadness, I think, for me that undervaluation has, you know, continued for as long as it has, but it's obviously great that we're correcting that now. The average is just over 30. But there's a huge range in that. One of the largest claims was for Kei Arahi I Te Reo, so the specialist teachers generally in primary schools and come in and do a lot of teaching around Māori language, but also, you know, cultural practice, and they play quite a strong advisory role in schools. And their average pay correction was just over 70%, which is huge. And the recognition of the skill that these generally, usually women, bring, and the fact that, you know, they're not just doing it for the love of it, but, you know, and they are, but that actually there's huge skill and value which they bring in this work as well is fantastic. Of course, we're still not paid equally for our work. In 2022, the national gender pay gap was 9.2%. And now that's an improvement from the 13.1% that it was in 2017, but it's still not zero, which is the ultimate goal, obviously. So whilst those pay equity claims have made a significant difference and will definitely be contributing to that decreasing pay gap, there's still a lot more to do. There's actually even more people covered by claims which are currently in the pipeline than which have had claims settled already. So significant numbers of working people being impacted positively by these equal pay claims. And it's really important that whoever is in government next is working at pace to settle these claims, because some of them are taking a really long time, 5 years plus. But is also willing to adequately fund the settlements of the claims as well, because we're finding that that has been a real challenge in certain industries to actually get the commitment from government to adequately fund the settlements. And this isn't, I mean, there is a bargaining aspect to equal pay claims, but this isn't collective bargaining. This is an objective measure of this is the undervaluation and this is what these workers should be being paid. So there really shouldn't be delays because governments aren't wanting to adequately fund that pay correction. But we need to know that any future government will commit to adequately funding those claims and settling them fast, because it's just not right that people are having to wait as long as they are currently. Another strong priority for the union movement coming into the election as well is fair pay agreements. We, in preparation for our election campaign, undertook some focus group polling, did quite a bit of research finding out what the issues are which are most impacting people in New Zealand, and unsurprisingly, the biggest issue by far is cost of living. And that has, you know, continued to dominate the conversation around the election. Fair pay agreements are a great solution to the cost of living crisis, because one of the biggest things that you can do to support people in a cost of living crisis is ensure that people are actually adequately paid for the work that they do. So fair pay agreements, in case there isn't anyone who's super familiar with them, is a form of collective bargaining, and it's sector-based or industry-based. So rather than what we have currently in New Zealand, which is workplace by workplace, it will cover a group, a much larger group of workers across an industry or a profession, regardless of their employer or location. So this will sound a lot like the old award system, because it is. it's basically there are some significant differences, but that coverage of an entire industry is a strong similarity that it has with the award system. One of the main differences, though, is that these are bargained rather than conditions and terms being set by a third party. So an example of where we see fair pay agreements being really beneficial is lifting the wages and improving the conditions of some of our lowest paid workers. Workers like cleaners, supermarket workers, security guards, people working in hospitality, shout out to the wonderful staff at Yaza Cafe, and also in ECE. In our views, the pay in these industries is way too low. But it's not just about the pay, it's actually about the security of work. It's about training, it's about often the unsociable hours which workers in those jobs undertake. Because at the end of the day, that all means that many workers are burnt out and they have inadequate time for their families, and they don't have a clear career path about how they can develop and grow in the industries that they're working in. And that, fundamentally, is because employers for a very long time, since 91, but actually, you know, possibly longer than that, have been allowed to compete on driving down rights at work. And this is an issue that we've seen across most of the economy. For 40 years, workers have been getting less and less of the income that their hard work makes, because in this country it's legal to put that pay and the hard work and your hard work as a worker on the market and then effectively bid to drive it down. Employers can compete on other grounds. They can compete on developing great products and effective services and efficient processes. But in many industries in New Zealand, that competition has been happening on the back of working people. And there's a personal story which I like to tell, which kind of exemplifies for me why this is really important, but also is a reflection on why I care so much about fair pay agreements. I lived in Melbourne for a few years when I was at high school, and when I came back, when I was at university, I had a job working for a clothing retailer. It was a Trans-Tasman company, and I had a friend who I'd been at school with who also had a job with this same company, and we also happened to work the exact same hours, which sounds like a total setup, but I promise you this is a true story. We both worked a Sunday, and we both worked like a late night on a Thursday, I think, for sort of 3 hours. So we both did the same hours on the same day for the same company. We'd both been working there pretty much the same amount of time. You know, we got these jobs when we started university. But when comparing notes with her about this work, it emerged that she effectively was earning twice as much as I was each week. And this was at a time when, in New Zealand, I think the minimum wage was about $13.50. And, of course, the minimum wage for the retail sector in Australia was higher than that. I think it was about $17. and they had time and a half on Sundays. And whenever she worked overtime, there was time and a half. And all of this added up so that effectively she was working, she was earning twice as much as I was. And that was in Australian dollars as well. And I remember feeling just so furious. It felt so unfair because it became evident to me at that point that this company could afford to pay me more. They just didn't want to pay me more. And my friend who was doing the exact same job for the exact same company was earning significantly more than me. And that was because of the modern award system that exists in Australia. It was because there was industry bargaining which existed to support workers in industry like retail to have those terms and conditions which recognise the unsociable hours of working on the weekend or late nights, which recognise the value of the work that you do adequately. And that for me, you know, that's my story, but I also know whenever I share that story, I hear other people who have similar stories. We all know somebody that's moved to Australia to work in hospitality because they earn significantly more than what they earn in New Zealand. And it's the case across countless industries as well. And at the core of it, it's because of industry bargaining, which exists in Australia and not in New Zealand. But it also exists very broadly around the OECD in general as well. New Zealand is an outlier for not having had this kind of industry bargaining. So we think it's really important that we keep fair pay agreement legislation. The legislation passed in December, and we have, gosh, I've lost track. I want to say it's about 7 fair pay agreements currently in train. One is already in bargaining. The buses FPA is currently in bargaining. And, you know, we've all heard stories about the impact that the tendering system that we have currently has had on bus drivers, where basically all companies can do to compete for contracts is drive down the cost of labour by paying bus drivers less and less. So bus drivers are currently in bargaining, but we also have FPA meetings happening across a range of other industries. Currently, hospitality industries the hospitality industry is having meetings. That's an industry of well over 100,000 working people that the FPA in that industry would positively impact. So it's essential from our perspective that fair pay agreements are able to continue and become a reality for workers in those industries. And it's of concern to us that National and Active said that basically they'll be gone by morning tea, because the positive impact that they can have on those working people is really significant. As I said, it's not just about pay, it's not just about increasing wages, but things like having similar conditions around health and safety and training across industries will actually help those industries thrive and grow as well. So from our perspective, they will actually also bring benefit to employers also. So there have been some significant wins in the last couple of years for working people, but there's a lot more that still needs to be done from our perspective to ensure that all working people in New Zealand are paid fairly and are treated with dignity at work. I talked before about tackling pay equity. One of the reasons that we continue to have challenges in the pay equity space in New Zealand is the lack of transparent information on pay. It's really difficult for workers to know that they're being discriminated against if they don't have information on pay in their occupational sector. Now, for union members, this is less of an issue because there are very proactive, open conversations about pay. But that's not the case for most working people. And so one of the ways that we can address that is through pay transparency mechanisms. One of the main pay transparency mechanisms is pay gap reporting. And again, this is a process which exists right the way across the OECD. We're an outlier in the fact that we don't currently do this. And many of the large companies which operate in New Zealand, if they operate in Australia, they're already doing this because it's the law over there as well. So this isn't a wild idea. The government has committed to implementing a pay gap reporting scheme, which would require businesses with over 250 employees to report on their gender pay gaps. And then after four reporting cycles, or so 4 years, businesses with over 100 employees would be required to undertake that reporting. They'd report on mean and median gaps, and they would be encouraged to develop action plans which would cover what they're planning on doing about the gaps, what's driving the gaps, and how they can be rectified. We know that 80% of the gender pay gap is driven by factors that can't be explained by differences in education, occupation, or employment conditions. And a mechanism like this will help expose where that unconscious bias is creating discriminatory practices, not always deliberately either, but where that kind of discrimination exists within workplaces. The requirement on businesses will be that that reporting also happens to an external agency, and it will also be made public. So this will empower both people working in particular industries to see what kind of gaps exist for, you know, in the business that they work for, and across the industry more broadly. But it will also provide information for consumers as well, and looking at who's taking action to try and decrease pay gaps as well. The union movement's been really strong, though, that if we're undertaking this work, we also have to be looking at ethnic pay gaps, because we know that as soon as you lift the lid on gender pay gaps and you account for ethnicity, it paints a completely different picture. The largest and the most persistent mean pay gaps appear between Māori women and Pākehā men at 23%. And if you compare Pacific women to Pākehā men, those pay gaps are 24%. So it's significantly bigger than that, just over 9%, which is the average, right? And for Māori women, the gap is actually higher today than it was in 2020. So if we don't account for ethnicity, we're only solving part of the problem. As far as we're aware, there aren't any other countries around the world that do ethnic pay gap reporting. There are some complexities with how you report on ethnicity as opposed to gender. It's just statistically more straightforward to report on gender than ethnicity, but we don't think that that's an excuse to not do it, because we know that ethnicity is a key component in that pay discrimination. So if we're doing this work, we should do it thoroughly, and we should take ethnicity into account. We also think that really these mechanisms should apply to as many people as possible, that we shouldn't be missing groups of people out on these on this sort of this right to transparent information just because they work for a small company. Ultimately, this is around a shifting culture. So moving away from a place where pay secrecy is the norm to one where people feel empowered to talk about pay, and that they feel a sense of agency around that. And that's quite a bold place to be moving to. But ultimately, it's actually one which empowers working people in their working lives. And so we think that it's really important. We also think that in having those action plans, it's really important that working people actually have an opportunity to engage and contribute to those working plans, so those action plans, so that it's not something which is being done to working people, but it's being done with working people. I'm conscious of the time, and there's so much more that I want to say as well about the work that is still to be done. In the union movement, we often We finish one thing and we're immediately on to the next, and we don't take a lot of time to sort of celebrate our wins because there's always more work to be done. But I will just say that, and I suppose this is, you can probably pick up on a bit of a thread about the things that I care about the most. On the topic of pay equity as well, there was a study by Princeton University economist Henrik Klevin, which showed that motherhood accounts for up to 80% of the gender pay gap, and that women with no children actually have earnings which are comparable to men's salaries. And in New Zealand, fewer than 1% of New Zealand men take up paid parental leave, and about 4% take unpaid leave. And we think that we need to move to a place where there is greater opportunity for secondary parents to take leave as well. Aside from the obvious benefits of people wanting to spend time with their new babies, there is clear benefit to women in terms of being able to return to the workforce should they want to, by having that greater flexibility. So we quite favour an Icelandic model. In Iceland, they have 39 weeks, 13 weeks have to be taken by the primary parent, 13 by the secondary, and 13 is flexible. You can choose who takes what. So there's flexibility, but there's actually an explicit encouragement towards the secondary parent, usually fathers, to take leave, to bond with their baby, to be engaged actively in parenting their children. ECE is also another area of real challenge for a lot of women. ECE is really expensive. It's often quite hard to access. I have a very nearly 2-year-old, and I am still on some waiting lists that I signed up for when he was just born. So that's 2 years of waiting lists. Luckily, I found somewhere else. But there's a real lack of quality ECE in a lot of places in New Zealand. And there's a toss-up, which a lot of families do, of this is the cost of ECE versus this is what I'm going to earn, and actually it doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, obviously if parents are choosing to stay home and look after their kids, fantastic. But if it's being forced on them because there's no financial benefit to returning to work, and actually that's something which ideally they'd like to do, then that's a situation which is obviously going to lead to inequity further down the line. There's a lot more to be done. There's a lot of work which we want to see done around protecting contractors. There's an increase in contractors in the workforce, and we need to look at legislative protection to ensure that they aren't in situations of exploitation, which is the case for far too many of them. We really want to see New Zealand ratify C-190. That's the ILO convention preventing violence and harassment in the world at work. We want to see WorkSafe and our Labour Inspectorate adequately funded so that they can actually undertake the work which they are charged to do. We want to see investment in just transitions, which is the ability for working people to be moved proactively through active labour market policies, through training into other industries when the work that they do is likely to be negatively impacted by changing technology or climate change, whether that's through certain areas no longer being places that we can work in, or because there are industries that are sunset industries and which we ultimately will need to phase out. We want to see working people protected through that process. A key part of that is having a social unemployment insurance scheme, which was a key policy for us, is still a key policy for us. And this is around ensuring that working people are actually adequately supported when they find themselves without a job before they get the move into a new work, so that they're not experiencing the kind of wage scarring which a lot of New Zealanders do currently. Ultimately, we think that working people need to be at the heart of what we do from a policy perspective in government, and that to create communities and a country and a world which is just and equitable and inclusive, and one where we stand shoulder to shoulder with each other in solidarity, and where housing and health and food and education and all of our security needs are met, and where we have what we need to survive, but more than that, we actually have access to decent work, where community and the environment and te tiriti are honoured and given an opportunity to thrive. A world where we have time and energy and resource to enjoy the things which make life worth living, family and friends and art and hobbies and recreations. There's a well-known slogan in the union movement, used particularly by women's groups, which is a poem by James Oppenheimer. It's the idea of bread and roses, some of you might be familiar with. There's a quote, "Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses." You can take roses literally, and as an enthusiastic but very amateur rose gardener, I sometimes do. But it, of course, is a metaphor for everything else which is good in life, everything that is more than just scraping by the bread on the table. So much of what has happened in the last 6 years helps support that move towards roses, to moving us beyond just having the bread on the table. We feel like there's such a momentum for working people currently, but there's still so much more that we need to do as well. And so we're hopeful, we're a little bit nervous about the upcoming election, and we're putting everything on the line to try and make sure that after October the 14th that we have a progressive and worker-friendly government, because we think that it's not just individual people's lives which are impacted by the kinds of policies that I've been talking about tonight, but it's actually our communities and our country writ large, ultimately our world as well, which benefit from working people being engaged and having collective power and living lives where they have time beyond work, where their needs are adequately met financially, where there's agency and dignity in work as well. And a key part of that for us, obviously, is union membership. And at the heart of union membership is collective decision making, and it's empowering people to come together in conversation. And I think that's an area of similarity which we have with this group here as well, because this kind of a conversation is at the heart of democracy, which is one of the key values which the union movement holds dear as well. So to conclude, I want to thank you very much for facilitating these kinds of conversations, because I think we need more spaces like this in New Zealand. It's really important that we engage in the kinds of issues that you do with the speakers that you have. And I want to thank you very much for your time. Nō reira. Thank you very much, everyone.
That was Melissa Ansell-Bridges, recorded live at Spirited Conversations at Yaza Cafe in Nelson during September. Spirited Conversations air Friday afternoon at 3, replaying on Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Podcasts of this and previous episodes can also be found at freshfm.net and the accessmedia.nz app. Just look for Spirited Conversations. I'm Jan Marsh. Thanks for joining us for Spirited Conversations at Fresh FM.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.